Welcome to the Audit Committee, accounts meeting for Charnwood Council. As Ed has just done, the meeting's been recorded and it will be made available on the website following the meeting. Please, no, we don't need microphones now. Oh. You just need to shout.
Hello.
Under the openness of local government bodies, people may film or record this meeting outside at council's control, but this should be done in a way that doesn't disrupt the business. Please could you also just check that you've got your mobile phones switched on to silent, and that Alexa, Siri, Cortana are switched off as well, as they can record and it's in breach of GDPR. We do have a time limit of 2.5 hours, but we shouldn't get anywhere near that. If the meeting's still ongoing, then we can decide whether to extend it, but only to finish what we're going to start. Before we do start, I just want to say, Mark's just mentioned it would be good, if it's okay with everybody, to move item 7, the external audit completion report, up to item 5. Because what Mark has to say will obviously impact on maybe questions and what we have to think about the government AGS and the statement of accounts. Okay, so item 1 is apologies. Do we have any?
No apologies received, Chair.
Okay.
Got Councillor Hadjinicolou trying to ring. Hello.
Part of the apologies, then.
Yeah, should be. Yeah. The door's open, I think. Which door are you?
The front door is.
Oh, the front door. He's outside the front door.
Yeah.
Front door.
Yes, please. Someone's going to come and get you, mate. All right. Thanks. Bye. I think we just pause until Ed comes back
as he's effectively taking the minutes. Do we need to check if Kerry can hear us, or is she only joining us at a certain point?
She's only listening in. She's not here for any items.
Okay. Can you hear us, Kerry?
I'm having my tea.
He's just signing in.
In case he has any. Okay, let's move on to item 2, disclosures of pecuniary and personal interests. Does anybody have anything to declare?
That's all 2 minutes, Chair.
Yeah, right, okay, sorry. Item 2, minutes. Sorry, thank you. So can you confirm that you're happy to receive not the minutes? Yeah?
Sorry, I wasn't there.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm happy to confirm.
Lovely, thank you. Minutes have been accepted as a correct record, thanks Ed. Okay, item 3. You just want to make me say that word again, don't you? Disclosures of pecuniary and personal interests. Does anybody have anything? No? Thank you. Okay, questions under any other committee procedures? Any questions? No questions submitted. Okay, thank you. So then if we move Mark's item forward, the external audit completion report. Mark?
Yes, thank you. So please interrupt me if you can't hear or would like any clarifications. The audit completion report is here for your attention. It confirms, and fundamentally the piece I want you to take away is that we are prepared and ready to sign and close the financial statements today. There's no concerns and the accounts are true and fair. A couple of things that we can't do. We cannot issue what's called the audit certificate at this point in time. And that's a formality that is linked to statute about closing the audit. We cannot do that because we have not received information on the whole of government accounts completion work from the National Audit Office. And therefore that is reflected every single local authority in the country. It does not put you in an outlier. In terms of our work, if I take you to I've got page 121 of the pack, which is our executive summary, and that really covers the aspects that we're going to talk about. So there's a couple of blue, I'm not sure if it's in colour or not, but there's a couple of blue boxes on mine which cover the audit opinion and on value for money. So first and foremost, we're proposing what we call an unqualified opinion without modification. That's the exact opinion that you want. It means we conclude that the accounts are true and fair. In terms of value for money, members may recall that the structure for that has changed in 2020-21 with various changes coming through the Code of Audit Practice from the National Audit Office. We've carried out our work and we've concluded that there are no significant weaknesses in arrangements. Again, that's what you want from us. I do the confirmation that the authority's arrangements for financial sustainability, for informed decision making, and for improving economy efficiency and effectiveness are sound. We use the word adequate, and you will never get anything better than adequate from us. So in terms of your gauge, it is always almost a inadequate or adequate, and you've met the bar for that. If I take you to, here we go, I think section 4 of the report, if I just broadly give you an overview of section 4. Section 4 gives you the significant findings from our work on the financial statements. Again, the fundamental message I want you to take away is that the accounts are true and fair. We carry out a detailed risk assessment at the beginning of the audit. Our audit risk assessment review of the local authority is in line with other local authorities. That means the financial reporting risks that we identified are consistent and not, and therefore is nothing unusual or out of the ordinary in terms of your financial statements. It confirms we've carried out all of the procedures we said we would, and we've concluded on each of those. Towards the back of that, in section 5, we talk about internal control recommendations. Our audit is not designed to detect control weaknesses, but through our work we identified a few minor matters that we thought would be useful to bring to your attention. We will work with officers to close all of those out as we do our 20, 2021-22 audit. But none I would consider giving us any cause for concern. Section 6, I will pause on, that's page 139 of the pack. And the reason why I pause on that is twofold. One, firstly, as part of our approach, we will always report to you any differences or potential errors in the financial statements over a threshold of £55,000. This year we've reported an item that extrapolates to £271,000. This will be appended to the management representation letter. And as an audit committee, you ought to pause at this point and confirm whether you will accept the rationale for this not to be adjusted in the accounts. Essentially, what we have identified is that income works on a 12-month cycle, so or 52-week cycle. So in the financial statements, there's 52 weeks worth of income. But if the start date was the, let's just say, the middle of March, in accounting terms, what you should do is cut off the 2 weeks at the beginning of the year, then add 2 weeks of the rest of the year to get you at the same 52 weeks. So the numbers you end up getting the same, is just the accruals concept would say you ought to match it to the financial year. We've only calculated 1 year's worth of impact, and we're calling that works out as £271,000. What that doesn't do is take into account of what it might have been last year. And it might have been because of changes in leases, and I'm using this, I'll be clear, this is an example, not an exact number, but it might have been 275 last year, it could have been 265. So the actual impact in the year is unlikely to be the full 271, but we have to report that to you. Officers have not adjusted for that because the accounts contain a full year's worth of income. But it is appropriate that as a committee you note or not note your acceptance of that approach. So I think it's just worthwhile me pausing there just to allow you to do that.
Could I just ask, Madam Chairman, is this going to continue through each year then? Are we saying that it's something that's hereditary and it's going to continue and you're going to bring this up every year?
We may well bring it up. But now that we've recognised it, we can now focus on the movement in the year. So if the movement in the year for next year, so as I said, if this is 271 this year, and next year it might be 281, that is likely to fall below our threshold for calculation. Because now we've got a benchmark in which we can work with. So we may not raise it again next year. But until we've done the work, I won't commit to that. Mm.
Can I ask a question about this as well? Have you identified this in any other authorities?
Yes. Lots of authorities do this. It's not unusual.
Any other questions around this? Anybody? Sorry, Leslie, did you want to?
I can just comment on that. Obviously, we set the, it was the first year of commercialisation of the leases, so I think this is why it's happened in the first year. And like Mark said, we as part of our year-end procedures, ensure that we've got either 12 months, we've got the four quarters in, but we will take this on board and make sure that, obviously, there isn't any significant changes sort of going forward. I think because this was the first year of the commercialisation, this is perhaps why it's actually happened. So that's the rationale behind what's happened. But as Mark said, when you do things on an accruals basis, that there is a sort of a start point of it all. So that's the reason behind it.
I think it's reassuring to some extent as well that Mark's saying that it's happened across the board in other authorities too, and it's not just here.
Is that £271,000 reflected in the commercialisation totals in some way?
This is So our approach, and so I'll just give you a word of caution around the 271. Our approach is an extrapolation. So this is a, so for, because we test on a sample basis, so again, I'm going to use numbers that don't reconcile the 271 because the maths is easier in my head. But let's just say we test £1 million worth of income and we find an error of £100,000. We then extrapolate that across the £1 million. So it's equivalent to like a 10% error. Right. So you would say the factual error that I've just described is 100,000. But potentially another 10% of the untested could be incorrect as well. So it's a, it's, it should be treated with a word of caution. The income is in the accounts. There is no impact in terms of the general fund as a result of this.
Okay.
I think because they obviously only test a sample, they can't test everything. Yeah. And I think the onus will be on finance next year to identify now this has been raised as an issue.
Yeah.
To make it more accurate in future years. All accruals and prepayments, it's that's the accounting adjustments that we kind of do a bit of that with sometimes, don't we? Because we have to. Okay, are there any other questions?
Chairman, if I go to page 129, significant findings, on the top, second line it says we have determined there is a significant risk in this area. And then in the audit conclusion, it says whilst there are no significant issues arising from today, section 2 of the report, a number of queries are outstanding and yet to be finalised and confirmed. Is that still the case?
So, no, all of our work is complete.
Right.
Everything is, everything that's has been closed off. There was, I think the time we drafted this back in November time, there's a couple of little bits left outstanding that we cleared. So I can confirm there is no work outstanding. There are no further adjustments or unadjusted items to report in the accounts. And if I may, that takes me to page 140 of the pack, which is a very, and I think, a very short page, but that's a good thing. There were no adjustments to the accounts that we made as a result of our audit and a few disclosure adjustments. And the message for the committee is that the accounts presented for us to audit were of a very good quality. We had the full support of officers throughout the process, and that has led to the fact that this is a clean piece of work. And I can say that is not the case in all of our audits. So it was certainly a trying time for the finance team, but, you know, putting together a set of accounts and also, you know, dealing with auditors at the same time as having lots of other things to do. But this is a good result for the authority.
Mm. And Chairman, I think we ought to record that to thank officers for the what they've done through that.
I was going to say it's good that throughout the report that we've got the full cooperation of management in there, which has been good. And it's actually good to see the progress given where you were when we were supposed to do this back in December and where you are now from an external audit perspective as well. It's good to note that progress. So yes, I did want to do that. I do have one further question, if that's all right.
Of course.
But she's gone, hasn't she?
Yeah, I just try to get it back.
The other question I had was because of your obviously recommendation around PPE, what I was looking for confirmation is when have internal audit been involved in that? Was there any internal audit done on any PPE any time? And did they find anything? But obviously Kerry's not with us now, so maybe that's something for.
Not that I recall, I don't want to talk on Kerry's behalf, but I very much doubt that the scope of their work would have gone to this approach.
Yeah.
And that's not a reflection on internal, I just think it's just not an area that they
so
might.
It's a different focus between internal and external, but I wasn't aware if any PPE, internal audit review, had been conducted.
I don't recall that. I go through, we periodically have an internal audit update, so I don't think there's been any work in that area mm-hmm. for 18 months or so. My memory's not necessarily great, but I certainly don't recall anything over recent months.
Okay, but I guess they'll be following up on external audit recommendations anyhow as part of the internal audit work, so.
Chair, I think what generally happens is the internal audit have their own internal audit plan that's sort of slightly independent, so they'll take look at the internal controls as it's sort of one of their primary sort of year-to-year things that they do. They do full systems audits, which they did a full systems audit last year. In terms of if there is any recommendations here that we want them to follow up, we can certainly do that. But I think the internal audit, I think the external audit don't rely on the internal audit, actually. You know, everybody works independently, so I think in the past they would have perhaps worked together, but we do, the two functions are completely independent. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, but given this was about kind of a reconciliation, in effect, which reconciliation is one of the internal controls of an organisation, isn't it? So perhaps it's something that we need to make sure that is.
Well, I was going to suggest, and I was going to put it under when we were looking at something else, that because I'm new to the committee as well, I'm quite interested in the relationship between the internal and external audit. And you've probably answered some of that question now this evening, but I think that in some ways, my view is that it should sort of go together, if you like, in terms of that. And I can't weigh that up, because we get a lot of it reports from internal, and then we look at the external, and I just think there should be some tie-up there, but you're saying no.
No.
if we go back, just in history, so when we used to have the audit commission used to be our auditors, and this is going back probably about six, whenever the audit, up to when the audit commission...
10 years.
So a long time, but they used to insist that internal audit looked at, did some work. So they used to have basically a knitting pattern, and internal audit would do this. And they always used to say, the internal audit is independent, they don't have to do it, but if they don't do it, we'll do it and we'll charge you. So, in effect, that's what the internal audit used to do. I think now there's probably a slightly different exam question, so Mark and his team have to focus on basically getting to that small audit report, actually are the accounts true and fair, whereas internal audit look at our internal controls, which would include reconciliations, but particularly they would focus on things maybe more liquid, so obviously cash, contract, debtors, creditors, that sort of thing would be maybe met where more of the internal controls or payroll. Mm-hmm. And then they do what internal audit would do are other things that aren't necessarily directly related to the account, but things, for example, like looking at our section 106 processes to make sure that we're actually controlling that process, so we've got, so we understand when the money by, that sort of thing, which wouldn't necessarily be anything that Mark and his team would look at, but in terms of our performance and avoiding issues with that sort of thing, that's what we look at. And things like things like petty cash counts at the museum, which is small, but we have a few that everywhere in the authority has a look at. So there are some things we look at just for, because it's their time, and other things we would look at on more of a risk basis. And things. The other thing, of course, the internal audit team have been doing a lot of work on at the moment is on business grants, and there's been millions of pounds flowing through that. Yeah. So there's been lots of work on that, and again, that's probably not something Mark would look at. So there are they have got slightly different exam questions, though obviously, internal audit will look at risks, and I think we'll look at what's come out of here, and using some of the contingency, consider whether that's appropriate for the internal audit team to pick that up.
So you're saying the risk, the probably they look internal more at the risk register and the risk associated with that.
I'll speak for Marv, I think they would look at, in here it documents the risks they've got, their risks of the financial statements not being true and fair. The internal audit risks are, some of them are more operational risks, so things like section 106, like the processing of business grants, the sickness recording, etc. So it's a lot of those internal processes which are important but wouldn't be necessarily
like the asbestos that's in here.
Looking at that. Simon, I was going to kind of help you out here. The slides that I've asked Ed to send round, so Councillor Parsons and I went on an LGA course week before, and there's actually within the pack of slides. There is an explanation there of the difference between internal and external audit and their focus. Yeah. So if you maybe want to have a look through those slides, that might help you.
Brill. If I may, Chair, I've got only one other point to make on the report and then I'm done. And that's page 142 talks about the approach to value for money. I mentioned before this new approach that was issued by the National Audit Office. Our work is not complete until we issue a new style report called the Annual Auditor's Report. So, one, I wanted to give you assurance that it could be a little bit confusing. Number one, we've not identified any significant weaknesses to report to you. It does say that we haven't completed our work, but as I say, that's only because we haven't issued the final report, which the code requires us to issue within 3 months of signing the opinion. So it is only a matter of timing that we're saying that, not a matter of any piece of work or any unidentified risk that we need to work through. So again, it's intended to be a piece of assurance for you around it. It has been a challenge this year, would be my polite way of putting change in the code that came in very, very late, and the way things were being reported that came in very, very late. But the assurance we're giving to you is the opinion will not, does not report any weaknesses.
Okay. And through you, Madam Chairman, could I just ask, it does say on there, considering the outcomes from the work of the internal audit.
Yeah, so we will always reflect on the work of internal audit. So for example, if internal audit looked at section 106 and they said it was a bag of spanners and full of, and also they haven't done this, but full of material levels of fraud, money's all over the place, then yes, we do want to know about it. And similarly, the other flip side is true. I'll call it a clean internal audit, gives us a site over control environment that says actually we don't need to pull up those stones and start that work. So yes, we will consider it, but we won't rely on it.
Just one question. When you sign off on the pension fund, so we're used to seeing quite large fluctuations in the pension value, and we're used to seeing that year on year. When you sign off on that each year, is your opinion that what you're signing off on is it's accurate, it's an accurate assessment, or are you given an opinion that the pension fund going forward is secure going forward? Is it just that you're saying the accounting of the pension fund is correct to the point where you give that opinion, or are you giving us a sense of security about it going forward?
So I don't sign off the pension fund
at all.
This is a Leicestershire pension fund, Granthorne Board of the Pension Fund. What I sign off on is that the figure in your financial statements, the council share of what's called the net liability, which is some of the pension fund assets versus how much you do, is a, and apologies for this, a materially accurate estimate.
Okay. So that it's not giving us a sense of security of the fund, it's giving us a sense that the figures we're being told by Leicestershire County Council are what they are.
Okay. If you want to look at the fund, you go to the...
You have to go to them, they're actuaries. Okay.
So, Mark, just for clarity for me, itself as well, but the fund audit will presumably look at those underlying assets. They would have a view that the assets, the valuation of the assets in fund accounts are basically correct, so it's not the...
It is a full audit of the pension fund, it's just I haven't opined on that. And
it's quite a specialised area, isn't it, to audit as well?
We do a couple of, we don't audit Leicestershire.
I think, Chair, just to add to that, I think this in this financial year accounts and the one previous year, we've actually had three separate valuations on that pension fund. So we have an initial one, then we get advised by Leicestershire County Council that Grant Thornton advised to do a second valuation. So I think this particular year there was three valuations done on that pension fund. So what's actually represented in our set of accounts is that we've decided to take those three valuations into consideration. I think we could have taken the view that we weren't going to do that, but I think given the guidance, we've actually gone ahead and paid for that extra assurance.
Thank you.
Yeah. Are there any other questions? No? Are we happy to accept the audit report and with the misstatement that Mark mentioned as well? Excellent. Thank you. Thank you. Well done, everybody. Okay, shall we move on to what number are we on to now? Item 6, the AGS and the Code of Corporate Governance. Adrian, over to you.
Thank you, Chair. So these are two items that are coming to the committee for consideration and approval. The annual governance statement is something we are required to produce and publish alongside the statement of accounts every year. It basically summarises the council's corporate governance arrangements and the review that's been undertaken during the year to confirm that they're operating efficiently and effectively, and any recommendations for additional actions that are required. And this year we're not recommending that there are any additional actions that are not already being carried out. Supporting the annual governance statement is the Code of Corporate Governance, which is a more detailed summary of our corporate governance requirements. About 5 years ago, SIPFA and Solis produced some guidance on how Code of Corporate Governance should be produced. At that time, we amended our corporate governance statement to reflect the headings and the bullet points within the SIPFA Solis guidance, which is the current format of the Code of Corporate Governance. And since then, over the last few years, we've just kept it up to date, really, where our arrangements and committee structures have changed to make sure it reflects current arrangements. I'm happy to take any questions, Chair.
Okay, thanks,
Adrian. Yeah, have we amended the way rental going forward is recorded, which sort of ties in with the Mazars report? And if not, it'd be helpful to know why not.
Okay. I'll have to pass to Leslie or Simon on that one, Chair.
Is that a statement of accounts rather than an AGS theory?
Possibly.
Do you want to save that one up then, Councillor?
Okay. Okay.
And Charm, could I just say, Adrian, there, Charm with our Council Code of Corporate Governance on page 16. When we look at behaviour with integrity and demonstrating strong commitment, it just mentioned codes of conduct are in place for members and officers. And then it goes on to say about members and lots of things that happen to members. But it doesn't say how we approve the code of conduct for officers. Does that happen, or is it something that's taken for granted?
Through you, Chair, the officer code of conduct is part of the constitution. So it's approved by full council in the same way that the members code of conduct is. It follows, the current officer code of conduct follows a national officer code of conduct that came out quite a few years ago now. There is no current national officer code of conduct, but we believe that it's sufficient and fit for purpose, and It's reviewed every year as part of the review of the constitution and goes to full council to be approved in the same way as the councillor code of conduct. I think in respect to perhaps the second follow-on part of that question, Councillor Snart, there's a disciplinary procedure in place if officers breach the officer code of conduct. It doesn't mirror the councillor, the process for dealing with council complaints, but there is a process in place for officers who may breach the code of conduct requirements.
Yeah. Well, could you just follow on there, please, Madam Chairman? When I look at the respecting the rule of law, the last one, whistleblowing, it talks about corruption, misuse of power and other serious concerns. Should we have put fraud in there as well?
Could you tell me which page you're looking at?
Yeah, sorry, 17. Top of 17.
I think you're absolutely right, Councillor Snart. We can definitely add that in because the whistleblowing policy does cover fraud. So, yeah, we could certainly add in fraud next year, unless you want it added in this year.
As soon as possible. So, I don't know whether it's possible to do that this year.
But the committee,
I would think it must be there as soon as possible.
Well, I think you could resolve, Chair. To approve, you know, if you wanted to amend the recommendations, like to approve the updated code of governance, attached as Appendix A, with the addition of specific mention of fraud in relation to whistleblowing arrangements.
Okay. Yeah.
People are happy with that amendment.
Any other questions?
Just a quick one. Page 21. It says the council has a dedicated page on its website where open data and all information required. Under transparency is readily available. Is it easy to find?
Yes, if you just search for, if within our website you just search for transparency. Or within one of the internet search engines, I'm sure if you typed in Charnwood Council transparency, it would hopefully take you to the page. I know it exists because I've looked at it.
Sorry, I had to giggle there. You were asking him to Google transparency. It wasn't that transparent then.
I didn't use the word Google, Chair. I just referred to internet search engines.
Thank you. Thank you.
Others are available.
Any other questions? I do have a few as well. Sorry. I've circulated my list of questions, and some of the things that we've discussed, given what Mark's said, are kind of covered, if you like. And I think my kind of overall one, I mean, I noted that there's lots of things in here that we could include whilst it's good to keep it short. And given that, you know, it was compiled in 2017 and it's only little really been tweaked since then. And obviously we've had lots of changes. We've had lots of new policies. And I noticed things like in there, we've got inconsistencies. For example, regarding the role of the audit committee, it doesn't say the same thing in our audit committee terms of reference, so we've got slight wording differences. And what I had a quick chat with Adrian about possibly is maybe having a kind of a grid of all of our different policies and saying which bit of the AGS it covers. I know they do it in other authorities. Perhaps, sorry Mark, could suggest some good practice in an authority that you've come across that could be we could look at?
Yeah, yes I can. Put me on the spot to think of some now.
I'm not asking you to do that now, but maybe you could share those.
Give you a list of some where we think there's some things to consider.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, because obviously they'll have seen a lot of different ones in different authorities, so I think that's probably quite a good one. Because it's good to make sure that we are not just kind of resting on our laurels. I mean, as an ex-auditor, the one thing I used to always hate hearing was, we've always done it like that. Leslie's going, yeah. And I'm sure you're the same now, Mark, as well. It's good to often look at other things and try and make sure we keep it updated. And often when you've got that grid, it means we don't need to mention things in here. So this could actually be slimmed down to some extent. And then it's as different policies come online, they're automatically included in just that one page as well.
I think on that, Madam Chairman, probably the one up to date is the Freedom of Information request, and I think that's in there.
But, you know, as new things come along, with a grid-type system, we could make sure they're in there. I don't know what officers...
More than I, Chair, as I said, I think when we discussed it informally before the meeting, if somebody can give us best practice examples, we're more than happy to look at what other people are doing and if necessary improve the way we set things out and the information we include. But it's difficult to know. You know, it's quite easy to go and find people that present it differently, but you don't necessarily know that whether just because it's presented differently, whether it's better, it's just different. So that's why it'd be helpful to have a steer as to what is best practice, I think, Chair, if possible.
Yeah, well, I think Mark's happy to do that. Thank you. Okay. Obviously, that's going to be changes for next year's AGS, not this one. Are there any other questions following on from that? No? Okay.
Excuse me, Chair. Could we, sorry, have we finished that item? Could we just possibly go back to the end of the previous item? If we just in terms of the recommendations, it's a couple of things. So one is to approve the accounts, and the Chair, as the presiding person, be authorised to sign the account, which is yourself. So we probably need to just make sure we formally do that. And also, there's a letter of representation to
the
board.
We're not on that one yet.
We've done the AGS. Yes.
We've swapped them around.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Right. That's okay.
Sorry. I've advised you myself.
Never mind. We were both asleep, Ed. Never mind. Apologies, Chair.
Okay, back to the AGS. Okay, so no more questions from anybody on the AGS. Okay. And are we happy to approve the AGS with the inclusion of the and fraud bit?
Well, that's the Code of Corporate Governance.
Happy to approve the Code of Corporate Governance with the inclusion of the and fraud bit. Yeah, okay. I think we have agreement.
And can Chair, just for clarity, can the committee also confirm that they approve the annual governance statement so it can be signed by the leader and the chief executive?
That's great.
Yes. Lovely. Thank you. Okay, thank you. Now on to item 7, which will be the statement of accounts. Leslie, would you like to present that?
I'll just introduce Chair, the statement of accounts, item 7 for 2021, pages 30 to 108 in the pack. So it's a set of local government statutory accounts to meet the accounts and audit regulations 2015 and in line with the SIPA code of practice. The major changes from 2019 are listed on pages 41 to 42 in the pack. I responded to the Chair's questions in an email this week, questions and comments, and we'll take these points forward into the 22 statement of accounts. I'd like to thank the accountancy team for providing Mazars with a good set of working papers, and look forward to working with Mazars again the next financial year. And if there are any further questions, I'm sure myself and Simon will be able to answer them. And there is a point on page 10 of the accounts to be signed by the Chair, and the section 151 to be sent.
Yeah, thank you, Leslie.
Thank you. Thanks, Leslie. Are there any questions?
Yeah, page 34. It'd be helpful to know the impact on the council of the large 16.83 million deficit in collection of business rates and the council's share of 6.8 million.
Just
Page 34. So
it's the impact it's going to have of that deficit would be what I'm after.
Yeah, this is a very complicated area because there are millions and millions of pounds flowing through either way. Now, in theory, the answer is basically nil. So the answer should be nil because we should be compensated for this business rates, this very large amount of business rate relief that has been given. The complication is that, how shall I call this? If it worked in a way that I thought was logical, well, the Section 31 compensation should flow through into the collection fund just simply to match the business rates that we're not going to collect. The way the accounting works is that Section 31 money effectively goes directly into our reserves and then leaves this deficit from the collection fund. So we've got the money on one hand and then we've got this big deficit on the other. And then this is where it starts to get technically, in that the government advises us about how that deficit should be spread and how that accounting should work. So in theory, the compensation should match the business rate relief given. And when you look at the detail of the accounting, so there's when you go through the returns, actually some things we get compensated for Section 31, so small business and rural relief, and some things we don't, like empty property. So all these things are all mixed together and teasing them out. So in theory, it should be the same. What might happen, and this is some of the detail we have to work out, is that there will be timing differences. So the deficit that the government will tell us, or we get instructions how the deficit should be closed. So in some years we might get some ups, and in some years we might get some downs. And it's one of those things that's going to be quite difficult to actually see precisely how it turns out because of all the other things in the mix. But the impact on us in terms of reserves, in terms of material difference, should be over a 3 to 5 year period, should not be material.
If I can, Chair, just add to that as well. On page 40, you'll see that the one-off COVID reserve fund is set up for 7.346. So if at the bottom of page 40, we've got a reserve to offset that going forward.
So it's not necessarily the most complicated bit of our accounts, but it's in the top one.
And I think we've got to take reassurance that these have been kind of approved from an external audit perspective as well.
All right. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Councillor Ball, do you have that earlier question, Councillor Ball?
Oh, I didn't I?
Well remembered.
Have we amended the way the rental going forward is recorded, which ties in with the Mazes report, and if it hasn't...
Could you repeat that? We amended...
The way rental going forward is recorded.
I think Leslie, it's just about, are we going to do the rentals on an accrual basis?
Yeah.
No, it's just that one, I think.
Yeah.
Through you, Chair, I think what we'll do in terms of year end, I think as Mark's described, we'll look at the accruals that we'll put forward. We'll ensure there's 12 months, yeah, four quarters. We'll look at the compensation of that commercial difference.
Yeah.
And then I'll ensure that the team are aware of this. They are aware of this issue, but in terms of the materiality of it, we'll certainly check that going forward. But we will certainly, as you can imagine, there's lots of income accounts, but we always ensure there's sort of 12 months or four quarters in the accounts.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Well, it's one must be partly answered by the external audit report with the reference to note 34. but I couldn't find anything that note 34 actually referenced in the accounts. In other words, I couldn't find the main note and any reference to it. Now, I know because of the nature of note 34, you might not want to disclose numbers or what it's about necessarily, but I was just slightly concerned I couldn't find the actual note in the accounts that it came off and you noted it in the external audit report. So I'll just find the page number for you where the reference is.
Is that the contingent liability?
Yes.
Yeah.
So part of it's just to understand if you're able to disclose the area it relates to. And the second thing is it just our opinion that it's not material, or is it potentially material, but our view is our liability might not be material? It's on page 93 of the report. It's page 58 of the papers, but page 93 of our actual papers. Note 34, contingent liability and contingent assets. Mm. It's been referenced by the external auditor in the final page and summary, but I can't find any note anywhere in the accounts that it refers to where note 34 is highlighted.
Question initially and then Mark possibly. We reviewed the legal dispute that the council have with the contractor, and we've reviewed the amounts that the legal claim that's included in the legal claim, and we have considered that it's not material. Liability from the head of department, and we've provided Mazars with the emails and working papers to reflect that. We haven't put numbers and we haven't put the contractor's name to obviously protect that organisation. I don't know if Mark's got any other comments on that particular note. It won't be in the accounts, because we've not actually put any figures in the accounts, because it's just at this moment in time it's not closed. It's just an open. It's in the legal proceedings. So until we've got assurance that we've got to pay that money over, at the moment of writing this report. We still don't think we've got a claim as such, so it's still in those legal position.
No, absolutely. It's an event that is continuing, an act that hasn't taken place yet, and therefore there's insufficient evidence to accrue or put any numbers in the financial statement.
Can I maybe supplement what you're saying and what you've said as well, Leslie, that the notes are there when we disclose something, it's things that we have to tell people about, but we don't necessarily have to change any numbers, but we have to tell people about the possibility.
I'm just trying to clarify in my mind. I understand what contingent liability is, I understand the nature of this, and I understand the confidentiality of it. I'm just trying to understand, is it just our opinion that it's not material? Or is it actually, in totality, not material?
I think in terms of the numbers, it's not material in terms of the totality of numbers. I think in terms of the claim, I think it's at the time of the cut-off for this report, it's still in legal dispute. If we do have to pay it, then we'll have to put those figures into our financial accounts next year, but it's not going to be material, as in a material amount.
Okay, and materiality for us, can you remind me what materiality is for us? Is it 55,000?
So, no, our trivial threshold would be 55,000.
55,000. So is that the one we're using here as a trivial threshold, or are we using the 1.5 million 2% threshold for materiality? Because there are two different levels of materiality.
So there's two elements here. There's our materiality assessment, and there's officers' materiality assessment. And The two are different. Ours is about assessing whether there's material misstatement in the financial statements.
Yeah, and that's 2% of the overall.
It would be 2% of an identified matter.
Yeah, and you number that 1.52 million or something. It's a figure against the two.
Our figure is 1.5 million, is our materiality assessment. But the key thing for us is whether there is or is anything to disclose in terms of the note. It's about the nature of the item, not the monetary amount at this point, is our view.
I don't know enough about it to put it in. You can't put it in. Because to give a figure might take people, give them the wrong opinion on something.
No, I understand that.
If Councillor Parsons wants to ask a question after the meeting, we can do that. But I think it's not material from an accounts perspective and from an office perspective. So there's a top amount which wouldn't be material, and what we assess is we don't believe we should be accepting any of that claim. But that claim is not—it's not binary. It would be, you know, there could be some process where we would end up paying 5%, 10%, 20%. But even if it was 100%, which we would view as extremely unlikely, and I think that's the basis of the legal documentation. Then it still would be. It would be quite lumpy, but it would be low. It would still need the accounts to unfair, I think, is probably where we'd be.
Are we able to provide a follow-up sort of update?
Well, it'll come through. If any councillors want to stay at the end, we can maybe talk more but informally and offline if you're interested in what is about.
My only other request is that we don't have numbers of notes in there that don't go back to somewhere in the account, because I spend 3 hours searching for them and can't find them. I have another question, if that's right, Chair.
Mm-hmm.
It's a question I've asked in different ways before, so it's obviously my inability to get to grips with it. So we are used to talking in this council most of the time about the general fund, and we talk about a figure of 17, 18, 19 million when we talk about the general fund. But in reality, once a year, when we see the totality of it, the general fund reported this year is 56.225 million is the totality of the figure of gross expenditure, page 46. From an assurance perspective, how are we assured about variances, differences, things that may or may not be right with the rest of the expenditure in the totality of the general fund? Because as councillors, I'm pretty certain if I went round the room most of the time and I asked every councillor what the general fund is, they'd say 70, 80, 90 million, that figure we deal with. But fundamentally, that's the gap funding. And the totality of the general fund is significantly bigger than that. So from an assurance point of view, how do I know that the rest of the process, that's all assured, because we get the variances on the gap funding reported to us, and we see the very large numbers which make up 56 million of the general fund. But just seeking reassurance about the totality of the general fund rather than just what we talk about nearly the whole time, which is that gap funding piece.
I think what you're looking at is the difference. So the income, so you've got the expenditure, so you've got the income and expenditure, and that's different to what's in the balance sheet in effect. So that just shows the pluses and minuses throughout the year, if you want. So you can't just look at the expenditure, you need to take into account the income figure as well.
If I can just answer that through the chair, obviously the set of comprehensive income and expenditure statements are they're monitored throughout the year in terms of the variance reports, and the variance reports actually filter through to the finance and performance scrutiny. They are separately internally audited, and then they are externally audited as well, in terms of those numbers are line by line ticked off by our external auditors, and those numbers are ticked off against our systems, our Unit 4 ledger. So in terms of assurance, those numbers are a robust set of accounts that tally to our Unit 4 system.
Okay. I think if you use this one to look at the difference, that shows the movement, so that will take into account the income expenditure.
Okay.
Any other questions? No, I think I have one overall comment, if that's all right, Leslie, based on the queries I sent through. That in terms of the narrative, I did find a number of mistakes throughout it from a general proofreading perspective. I've said, for example, that the second paragraph on page 2 just didn't make sense when you read it. There was dates missing later on and things like that, and you've obviously said that actually it's something that we will look at next year. You know, that the authority produces lots of fantastic documents, and with the best will in the world, us accountants aren't always the best people to explain things sometimes, and that narrative is there to explain things to people, and sometimes somebody reading it through that maybe isn't an accountant with a marketing background can kind of recommend changes and things like that and make it more understandable. And I guess that whole thing was really about that. You know, there was lots of abbreviations that were in the narrative that weren't then in the abbreviations at the end. Glossary of terms, and again that could maybe be expanded. So in Mark's report, for example, materiality, going concern, do they would need to consider putting things like that in to help people understand a bit better as well.
I think that's my personal view on this. Personally, I would rather the accounts we were able to disclose things in a more user-friendly manner, because I don't think actually, I've got a personal view that these aren't actually very user-friendly at all.
Mm.
And maybe just before I leave the authority, I might suggest we do a much simpler version of the accounts, and then I'll say to Mark, qualify and be damned, and then I'll be out the door.
Well, I think it's that narrative that gives you that opportunity to simplify things, doesn't it?
Possibly, but I think when it comes to some of the stuff that we deal with, I think you would have to be sort of do about a page of explanatory notes before you're then able to do the explanation. So it's, yeah, I think we'll take on board, and I'm sure some of the narrative can be better, but I think these is, you know, it is 85 pages of fairly indigestible stuff, if I'm honest, and you know, that they're the rules and regulations we work by. So, you know, I don't know whether Mark's got any personal views on the county disclosures.
I think it's very well recognised fact that local authority accounts are too complex and require some work done to it, including that was even an outcome from the most recent Redmond review.
Mm.
That suggested there should be a simplification. The solution was to add another statement in.
Yeah. Mm.
Simplification and clarification of local government accounts is something that I've been aware of as long as I've been training. It's something we would all like, but we need to work to the auditing standards and the accounting standards that are in place. So until those change, there's not much.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the notes I'm suggesting, it's that narrative that you put at the front to try and explain it.
The narrative report is within your gift.
Yeah, and I think that could be
the back end.
Maybe again, there's some best practice there, Mark. Sorry. Getting your money's worth out of him this year, you see.
Just one more question. In some of the various reserve funds we have that we move money in and out of on occasion, are those movements bounded by policies, or are they only done by circumstance? So if I were to look through each of the reserve funds, would I find a policy determining when money moves in and out of them, or are they all driven by circumstance?
We have got a policy, for example, on the reinvestment reserve that we top that up to £500,000, which we do sort of on a basis as required. Was the working balance getting to what I would view as Section 151 officer as a insufficient level, then I think the reinvestment reserve wouldn't be topped up. So that is for sure. Sometimes occasionally, we've considered it appropriate to take some of the working balance and move that into the capital plan reserve so that our capital plan's been protected. Again, I don't think we've done that in any material way in the last few years. So it is, and I suppose in fairness, it's underpinned by an approach, and some of that is documented within some of the reinvestment reserve approach, I think, is in the medium-term financial strategy. It's something we usually record in there, but I guess circumstances will potentially prevail, or could potentially prevail to cause us to change that allocation reserve.
Any other questions? No? Okay. Well, thank you for producing them, both of you. And are you happy to approve the statement of accounts and that I can be authorised to sign them off on behalf of this committee? Okay. And are you happy for the letter of representation to be approved first? For signature by the CFO.
Great. We haven't actually been through this. Everyone managed to read that. It's okay with that. I think it is a standard. I didn't spot anything that was anything different, but over and above that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Concludes our meeting now. Thank you very much. And it's good to see everybody here.
Thank you very much.